This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
So you know what's kind of funny? What's kind of funny is when you do a story on how the stock market seems to be ignoring the political chaos all around, and then the very next day, well, maybe it's not so funny, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 17th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know it looked bad out there today, but I do need to start here with some context, a little bit of perspective on the equities news of the day, which for the day, again, was grim. Yes, but a single day's trading losses do not a trend make. That's important. And it gets us to what we really wanted to talk about today anyway, by way of a follow-up to our What Did the Stock Market Know and When Did It Know It story of yesterday. That is the dollar. Now, I'm not saying currency traders are more on the ball than the folks in equities, but look, if the shoe fits, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
If you have a sinking feeling right now, maybe you're the U.S. dollar. Currencies are like real-time report cards for a country.
First show when investors are either nervous about a country or positive about a country.
Win Thin is global head of emerging markets at Brown Brothers Harriman. He says the dollar has been sending warning signs for several weeks now. Now, why might that be?
There's been some chaos in Washington, and the dollar is reacting to that.
Patrick Newport is an economist with IHS Market. But specifically, why does drama at the White House affect the dollar? Because it suggests that the U.S. government is going to be distracted from big policy changes for a while.
Markets generally realize that this bump that they were going to get from the Trump administration, this extra burst in growth, that wasn't going to happen. And so things came back to earth.
In fact, right now, the U.S. dollar index, a measure of dollar strength, is right back down to where it was before the election. One reason why currency markets have been so quick to respond while stocks have not is because currency is highly dependent on interest rates. You want to put your money in the country with the higher returns.
There is just some questions as to how quickly the Federal Reserve will raise rates, and it's that reassessment by the markets that I think is weighing on the dollar for right now.
Nick Benenbrook is head of currency strategy for Wells Fargo Securities. He says the slower first quarter growth in the U.S. economy has made investors worry whether interest rates will rise as fast as they initially thought. The political drama in the Capitol has just made them worry. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you're an equities trader, by the way, please don't yell at me. I was kidding. It was a joke. All right. Elsewhere in capitalism, a story from CNBC caught our eye today. Amazon, it seems, is considering a foray into prescription pharmaceuticals. Timely, no, as the Senate gets ready to do whatever it's going to do with the House's health care bill. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains what this might mean for the company and for its customers.
In its two-decade history, Amazon has upended several industries, starting with books. Its online store was a big factor in many brick-and-mortars going out of business. So, for drugs?
Any type of investment in pharmacy would probably be equally as strong and large and potentially disruptive.
Sucharita Mulpuru is an independent retail analyst. She says a move into pharmacy makes sense. Amazon needs to grow, and drug sales could be worth tens of billions of dollars.
The bigger question, I think, though, is what took Amazon this long? They had a stake in drugstore.com back in the 90s.
Which Amazon sold before the site folded for good. Since then, Amazon has built a lot of customer trust, something retailers need if they want to sell drugs, says Brendan Witcher, a retail analyst at Forrester.
Pharmacy is a great industry because it's a consistent purchase. It's a frequent purchase.
And like other retailers, Amazon could use prescriptions as a way to get people in the virtual door.
When customers buy, they tend to take advantage of opportunities to make other purchases.
The more price competition in prescription drugs, the better, says Joel Hay. He teaches pharmaceutical economics at the University of Southern California. He says people haven't had a centralized place to shop for prescriptions by price. Amazon could change that.
I think that would go a long way to improving the price for lots of products, both generic and brand name drugs.
But Hay says selling drugs is not like selling shoes. If Amazon moves forward, retail pharmacies will do whatever they can to cast doubt on the company's trustworthiness. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, seriously, big picture, okay? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You want to know what's coming to a TV screen or device of your choosing if you watch network programming that way? New York was the place to be this week. What are known as the television upfronts are wrapping up. Networks show off all their forthcoming content so advertisers can buy space up front, right? Marketplace's Adrienne Hill covers the business of entertainment for us. She is here with what is up with the NBCs and the ABCs of the world. Hey, Adrienne.
Hey, Kai.
All right. Talk to me for a second about how much business actually gets done at these things. It's a boatload of money.
It's a boatload of money. Yeah. $8.5-9 billion sort of money. And this is really prime time sales for the fall season. So a bulk of that ad inventory is being sold right now. Huge amounts of money. Some people expect this year could be a little cooler, but probably not going to drop off all that much.
Hang on a minute, because network ratings basically are down, right?
Way down. Right. I think we can say way down.
So on that whole you pay for what you get thing, you'd think that if ratings were down, upfronts would be worth less, right?
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. But look, primetime television offers something to advertisers that they really can't find anywhere else. That's a broad audience. There are still a lot of people in the sort of the age range they want watching. You've got content that you know is safe and appropriate to your brand. You will remember earlier this year the YouTube outcry. This is a safe place for advertisers. Right. They know high-quality content is going to be matched up against their advertisements. You got live sports still.
Yeah.
Big, big, big factor in all of this. And Kai, the final thing is there's limited supply. So if you're an advertiser, the last thing you want to do is not be there if the competition is.
Yeah.
So a lot of this buying is defensive buying, right? If you're BMW, you know Mercedes is going to buy, you're going to want to buy too. So you have a lot of people still coming at a very narrow band of advertising time.
Help me understand. I want to say innovation, but that's not really it, right? It's the whole you got to have new content and the buzzy thing. But you've got NBC bringing back must-see TV for crying out loud. This Is Us and I'll Say I'm a Fan is coming back. I mean, it's what's out there, I guess, is the question.
Reboots and more reboots and some spinoffs, Kai.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, American Idol canceled. Coming back. Will and Grace coming back. You've got Bachelor spinoffs. You've got Big Bang Theory spinoffs.
I'm opposed to that one, by the way. Young Sheldon?
Not for you.
Yeah.
If you are a fan of what network television has been doing, network television has some things for you this year. I think the buzzy, it's a hard place to try to be buzzy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to appeal to a broad audience. So you can't get too niche. And niche is often where the buzz is.
Hmm. Get me back to the whole business of the upfronts thing. I mean, there are these big glitzy presentations.
Right.
I mean, literally, there's parties and
singing
stuff,
and
right?
dancing.
How else does business get done, though?
So a lot of this business is getting done behind closed doors. And these networks are making really, really focused pitches this year. Look, they're saying, we've been behind with digital as far as targeting our audience. Mm-hmm. We didn't know as much about our audience as Google knows. We still don't know as much as Google knows, but they're getting a lot better at the data. They're getting a lot better at knowing how to find that mom who's looking to buy the minivan this year. Networks are trying to make the case to advertisers, hey, there's a lot more we can tell you about this audience, and this audience is actually a lot bigger than it looks on those overnight ratings.
Right. I am, just full disclosure, I'm a proud minivan dad. I'm just saying.
I'm on my way.
Adrienne Hill. Thanks, Adrienne.
Thanks, Guy.
After 5 decades of guerrilla war in Colombia, making peace is not only hard, it's expensive. In the big stopgap spending deal that passed last month, Congress authorized $450 million to help the Colombian government craft a durable peace with the FARC rebels. The stakes for the U.S. are high, too. There's a bilateral free trade deal between the two countries. American companies like Coca-Cola and ExxonMobil have significant operations there. And Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos is scheduled to meet with President Trump tomorrow. But there are challenges to the peace process on the ground, as Lauren Madelon reports.
When you drive through the hills of Meta, where the Andes Mountains cascade down into lush green valleys, it's hard to imagine the past bloodshed here. We're approaching a guerrilla camp. Meta was ravaged by a war that pitted Colombia's army and private militia against leftist guerrillas known as the FARC. Now, guerrillas have retreated to 26 camps as part of the peace agreement. Makeshift is the operative word at this camp. Crude housing with plastic sheeting. Few social services like clinics. Adinever Morantes is the FARC commander here.
El acuerdo de paz no avanza.
Colombians aren't seeing the security that peace was supposed to usher in, he says. So far this year, 27 human rights activists and indigenous leaders have been murdered. Morantes says guerrillas are worried they too will be targeted. FARC's retreat has left swaths of Colombia without authority, attracting criminal gangs, narco traffickers, and hired guns working for landowners. Now, Morantes says the army and police, the people he once fought, are his only protection from those threats. Morantes has a lot to say about the U.S. and Colombia. Trump or former President Obama, it doesn't matter, says Morantes. He says the Americans will help make peace because it's in their economic interest. U.S. government help in building peace is really important, he says. The FARC began as a rebellion against inequality in the 1960s. It then entered the drug trade to finance the conflict. And it sowed terror in rural Colombia, killing civilians and extorting businesses. The FARC is still on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Now, members of the FARC will be able to run for political office in Colombia. But the right wing here bitterly opposes that. Former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe is the right's leading voice.
You will never give impunity to Al-Qaeda nor to ISIS. Why in Colombia we have to accept impunity for FARC?
For rural Colombians in Meta, like 33-year-old Jason Pereira, words like that are an echo of his youth, when the pendulum of power swung between the FARC, the army, and right-wing paramilitaries. The government, the militias, the guerrillas, they're all practically the same thing, he says. Jorge Restrepo studies the economics of conflict at CERAC, a Colombian think tank.
We are not going to get back to war. We are not going to get back to having a narco-trafficking guerrilla group.
Restrepo says pockets of intense insecurity remain, but he points out statistics show an overall reduction in violence. He says U.S. military assistance used by Colombia to contain the FARC only went so far.
We were not being able to produce the security that we are enjoying right now through military means.
In Meta, Jorge Ivan Sanchez grew up fearing whichever group held sway here. Today, he's a lawyer who works for the Colombian High Commissioner for Peace.
Aportando mi granito de arena.
It is a challenge, but I'm contributing my little bit to this process, he says. He's helping to revive one of Latin America's largest economies, blunted by generations of war. In Meta, Colombia, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's been a real conspicuous silence, actually, around patient advocacy organizations on the issue of drug pricing.
Which means patients have to speak for themselves now. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, I totally would have gone with the wah-wah trombones. I don't know how you don't on a day like today. Biggest decline in months. Dow Industrial's off 372 points today, 1.7%, 20,606. NASDAQ off 158 points. 2.5%, 6,011. The S&P 500 off 43 points, 1.8%, 2,357. But as I said, some context here, gang, huh? The past 3 years, Dow and the S&P each up 25%, a little bit more, actually. The NASDAQ up 45% the past 3 years. So, context. Investors piled into safe havens. Gold up 1.8% today. Bond prices also rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And you have a lot of questions for us about business and technology.
Is automation going to take over even white-collar careers?
Do we actually make enough steel to construct large-scale infrastructure projects?
What is IBM Watson?
Watson, turns out, is a supercomputer that can probably beat you at chess and might even help you with your taxes.
Want to know more? I know you do. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talk a lot on this program about how what's happening in the national economy really kind of depends on how people are feeling in their own economies. So today, an interview along those lines, financial diaries of 235 American households tracked over the course of a year down to the dollar, so pretty specific, as a way to find out why people feel the way they feel about their economies. Jonathan Burdock is a professor of public policy and economics at New York University. Rachel Schneider is senior vice president at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Their book is called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. We're so happy to be here.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
The image you all use in the book, Rachel, is not the financial high wire act that we hear so much about when we're talking about personal finances in this country. Rather, it's a rocky, boulder-strewn road.
We do. We do think of it that way because, you know, we had this image, and it was really kind of a visual image. You picture this idea of a life over years, right? And it's this upward arc that we imagine, that you start out going to school, and then you get your first job, and then maybe you get married, you buy a house, and you, over time, earn more and more. And occasionally, sometimes, maybe something's going to go wrong, push you off that arc. But that if you save, plan, eventually you'll end up in a better place. And that's not really what we saw people experience. What we saw people experiencing was much more of an ongoing up and down, and not necessarily with an upward trend. And that leads people to really feel insecure and worried and stressed in a different way than I think we've really understood before.
There's a couple in the introduction to this book, Jeremy, and for the life of me, I can't remember his wife's name, and I apologize for that. He's an auto mechanic. Becky. He's an auto mechanic, and he's working overnights. And again, it's a volatile set of paychecks. But they eventually choose lower pay in order to get some stability. I mean, people are actually sacrificing to, I guess, Rachel, avoid that boulder-strewn road, right?
They are. You know, the Pew Charitable Trust asked this survey question in a national survey. They said, would you prefer greater stability or moving up the income ladder? And shockingly, 92% of Americans say stability. And so Becky and Jeremy are really acting on that same instinct. And it's really gives you this window into how people are thinking about their life, like what matters most. And we think in America that what matters most is mobility. Right now, what matters most for a lot of people is stability.
Is that an artifact of the recession and how, despite the headline numbers, so many people in this country, Jonathan, never got back to where they wanted to be?
We don't think it is. And of course, no one did this kind of study, you know, before the recession, so we can't really compare. But we see this shift happening really since the 80s. That jobs have changed, those sort of steady administrative, clerical, manufacturing, repair jobs that used to be in the middle of the economy and employed so many people and provided solid lives. You know, those jobs have disappeared. And increasingly are jobs that are not only pay less, but are less secure. And so we see a story that's really been happening for a long time, but that the recession has revealed. And so the big shift now is when we think about insecurity, it's not so much about, you know, will I have a job, right? It's not so much about employment. It's about insecurity within a job. It's Jeremy, the truck mechanic, who has a steady job, but he doesn't have steady hours and he doesn't have steady pay. And that's really the key.
The
there are broad themes in this book: spending, saving, borrowing, debt, earning is another one. What though, Rachel, is the here comes the hard question. What's the answer, right? What's the answer?
It is a hard question. You know, the big theme that really where we landed after doing all of this research and spending a lot of hours trying to process what we thought it meant was a theme about risk and the idea that individual families, individual people are bearing the risks of our economy instead of trying to spread those risks out over across institutions. So Jeremy's story is exactly that. He's bearing the ups and downs of demand in their employer's services. And really what we need is for larger institutions, employers, financial institutions, government, municipalities, right, name it, to take on a bigger share of the risk that families are experiencing.
The book is called The Financial Diaries. Jonathan Murdoch is a professor of public policy and economics at NYU. Rachel Schneider is at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rima gave us the corporate healthcare story up the top of the program, Amazon and prescription drugs. Now, the personal story of drug prices in the face of pending healthcare reform. We don't yet know what form a final bill is going to take. The Senate is still writing its version. But we do know people are paying attention. Witness the packed congressional town halls we have seen this spring about the repeal of Obamacare, yes, but also sometimes more specifically the high price of drugs and what impact those prices have on people. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has our story.
67-year-old David Mitchell loves to sing.
Okay, here we go.
He thought he'd spend his retirement with the National Philharmonic Chorale.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow.
Or head back to school, become a professor. Ultimately, David decided to use his voice like this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me here today.
In March, he testified in front of Congress at a hearing on drug prices.
I'm founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. We're a national organization focused exclusively on policies to lower prescription drug prices. To maintain our independence, we don't accept funding from any organizations that profit from the development and distribution of prescription drugs.
That's important because most major patient organizations do. In 2014, patient advocacy groups reported receiving $264 million from industry. University of Pennsylvania researcher Matthew McCoy says drug and medical device companies cut checks to more than 80% of the largest advocacy groups in the country.
There's been a real conspicuous silence, actually, around patient advocacy organizations. People have rightly raised questions. Well, they can't really speak out because if they do that, that might jeopardize funding that they depend on.
No one definitively knows if this money influences patients and their advocates to line up with industry. What we do know is drug makers are using patients' often very real and very desperate stories to help them get pro-industry laws through Congress. David Mitchell says the way they've monopolized the patient voice means it's near impossible to hear the other story, the one about how those high prices are hitting tons of Americans.
Patients all over this country are struggling. They're losing their homes. They're dipping into their kids' college funds. They are sometimes not taking their drugs, or they're cutting their pills in half.
Even seniors who are covered by Medicare face out-of-pocket costs as high as $12,000 a year if they have multiple sclerosis or cancer. To make his case, David's going to do what the drug makers have done so successfully, raise up the volume on patient stories, including his own.
More importantly for the committee, I'm a relapsed cancer patient with multiple myeloma. It's an incurable blood disease. Drugs are keeping me alive.
Yes, this is how David gets your attention. He's actually got $40,000 worth of drugs running through his body every month.
If you saw the x-rays, I looked at them once and I will never look at them again because I have holes in my skull and in my arm bones and in my pelvis.
Sometimes David catches himself, rubbing his arms, checking to see if his bones are still solid. But that day in Washington, David told the committee he's lucky. Between Medicare and savings, he and his wife, Nicole, can handle whatever costs come their way. Many can't. It struck a chord with Maryland Democrat Representative Elijah Cummings.
Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to make sure that President Trump hears your testimony because there are a lot of people that are going through what you're going through. And I thank God that you take your pain, turn it into a passion to do your purpose.
That's the power of being a patient and how to move an issue. And I don't know how good I am at the end of the day, but it's what I know how to do.
That's because for 30 years, he spent his career orchestrating major public health campaigns, like passing tougher seatbelt laws and working with mothers against drunk driving. And just 9 weeks in, this latest campaign seems to be shaping up. Patients for Affordable Drugs already has stories from 4,600 people. The group is mobilizing folks to support legislation, join conferences, testify. For David, though, this is more than just taking on the industry. For him, it's being part of something and a distraction.
I think it's this way for all cancer patients. You have to be optimistic. The idea that death is visible out there somewhere, it's crippling if I do that. So I don't.
It's taken time for David to get comfortable with his patient voice and all that it implies. But he says he's liking the sound of it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, two items from the historical record that resonate here in mid-May of 2017. We're going to take it chronologically. On this date in 1792, the Buttonwood Agreement was signed, creating the New York Stock and Exchange Board, now, of course, called the NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange, so there's that. There is also this, May the 17th, 1973, the first day of hearings by the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, known to history as the Senate Watergate Committee. All right, I'm going to give you the numbers. You got to promise me, promise, you're going to keep it in context, all right? The Dow off 372 points today, 1.7%. NASDAQ down 158, 2.5%. S&P 500 off 43 points, 1.8%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.